Thank you, Tom. And thank you all for coming this evening. It's wonderful to have such a gathering, and I really do look forward to hearing your thoughts and perspectives. And I want to thank you all for your tremendous support of our college. This is, as Tom said, a listening tour, and I'm traveling around the country and off to London in March. This is my 7th visit, and what I'm really trying to do is to hear your experiences, understand your perspectives, listen to your aspirations and your goals for the college. I want through this year, as we talk together tonight and afterwards, for us to create a sense of shared vision. Shared vision for where we want the college to go, shared vision for what the values ought to be as we, as the managers think about budgets and other things, shared vision for Swarthmore's role in the world. And we can only do that by talking to one another, by listening, by crafting together of shared vision. So as I said, this is my 7th stop on my listening tour. I'll do 12 this year, and we'll include London in that. But this is just the first opportunity. I hope you will all join the blog and feel free to make comments on the blog. But also, you can email me or call, or better yet, come to Swarthmore and visit me. And let's engage in a conversation. As Tom said, I'm going to say just a few words about some kind of initial impressions I have about Swarthmore, and then open it up for a while for questions, experiences, stories, comments. If the questions get too tough, as you can see, we've got lots of managers I can toss the difficult questions to. Since about 1990, I've been keeping a file. And the file's really kind of my hopes and dreams of liberal arts. I've, over the years, found some essays, a few, that really summarize or challenge me about the nature and essence of liberal arts and where they're going in this country. In 2001, an essay came across my desk that I knew was going to be the center of my file. That essay was entitled, "The Meaning of Swarthmore." Most of you know it. In this essay, written in bold, kind of dancing across the pages, are a variety of value statements. Unlimited opportunity. A tradition of excellence. The excitement of academic ideas. Purpose and obligation. A community of learners, making the world a better and more humane place. This essay, "The Meaning of Swarthmore," in 2001, became the center of my file. It anchors all the rest of the essays. And though I knew this essay summarized my deepest beliefs about liberal arts, I didn't know then that tonight I'd be joining you in talking about how we live out these values, how we steward this incredible tradition, and how we plan together for the future. So now I get to see these values lived out daily by our students and faculty, in the challenging classrooms, in the amazing research, often pioneering research undertaken by our faculty and students, in our academic program that is so rich and robust, that includes honors in research programs and arts and much more. And I'm beginning to see how Swarthmore alumni live out these values, not only in your professions, but also in your communities, in your contributions to the world, in your families. And I know it's probably wrong to lift up any one alumnus, because I could probably lift up each one tonight, But I'm going to just suggest one to you as an example of what impresses me about our alumni. His name is Jed Rakoff. Many of you know Jed Rakoff, class of 64. So Jed is a famous, I suppose, judge in the New York City area. He just turned down a $33 million settlement between Bank of America and the SEC. And that itself is a kind of interesting act. But what I found so Swarthmore about it is how he did it. He said that he was going to turn down the settlement because the settlement expressed a cynical relationship. And he quoted Oscar Wilde. Oscar Wilde once said that a cynic is someone who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. Judge Jed Rakoff, as a visiting judge on a panel one time, wrote a whole ruling in iambic pentameter. Again, you can agree or disagree with Jed's ruling, but you have to admit the rich intellectual style was a true Swarthmore act. I get to see the students engage in this incredible ability to think critically, to think creatively, to be engaged in the world. The joy of learning and thinking is joined with this rich critical rigor about thought and action and deed in the world. The students combine this kind of creativity and discipline in the classroom, but also what I like about Swarthmore is they do it outside of the classroom too, in a pterodactyl hunt, in the primal scream, in parish parlor parties, in 100 clubs and activities and arts and dance, and in all sorts of athletics. The students are fully engaged in learning how to build the world to make this a more and better place in all sorts of ways. Now, I could also lift up all sorts of students. Some of you are parents, and you know the amazing students we have on our campus, but I just have to tell you about one student who just did a spectacular kind of Swarthmore thing this weekend. And his name is Philippe Celestin, and he's made the winning soccer goal in the game against Hobart on Sunday in double overtime. This is the goal that let us go to the Sweet 16. Now, Philippe is an economics and political science major, and he isn't, I guess, Tom, you'd say he's not one of our stellar soccer players. In fact, this was his second goal, and he's in the class of 11 or 12? 11. So his second goal ever in his Garnet career and his first this year. But what's really something about this story is that on Saturday, he didn't play the whole game. He had consulted with his soccer teammates and the coach. He was very involved as a composer and a choreographer for an event on Saturday in the Rhythm and Motion, which is a large, incredibly amazing dance fest. And he had put a lot of time and energy into this artistic production, and then the soccer game came along. So what to do? And the team and Philippe decided that he would suit up, warm up, play the first period, and then he'd go off to produce his Strom dancing event at the dance fest. And that he did. And Sunday he came back, suited up, and played the whole game, and then had this amazing experience of getting the last goal. Just your average, well-rounded Swarthmore student. His parents in Haiti joined about 3,500 alums and parents around the country and the world watching the game on live video. They were incredibly proud of their son, who had this amazing experience. Econ, poli-sci, drumming, arts, athletics, all together. Watching the students and faculty work is a great thrill for me. And so many alums around the country so far have told me about their appreciation for the dedication of our faculty. And I have to say, the faculty, their faces just kind of light up. They love teaching these students. They love helping the students learn. Earlier this fall, I went to a science fair. We're about 68 students who'd done research with our science faculty over the summer did a poster session. And I saw this amazing amount of scientific research, the bleaching of coral, the cell-to-cell transmission of HIV, the annotation of music through a computer software program. One student has discovered, she thinks, a species of bacteria that will become her honors project. It's really an incredible level of scientific research that these undergraduate students get to have, because our faculty dedicate their summers, as well as their falls, winters, and springs, to helping our students learn. Over the summer, before the students and faculty came back, I talked with staff, but I also read about our history. I read about the presidents, because, of course, if you're a new president, you want to know their stories. So I read about Parrish and McGill and Adelot and all the very, very phenomenal presidents we've had. But I also read a lot about the Hicksite Quakers. As a scholar of progressive movements of religion in America, I knew a bit about our founders. I knew that they had been leaders in education. I knew that they had been strong abolitionists and most of them strong suffragettes. I knew that they dedicated their life to what the Hicksite Quakers call the amelioration of social ills. I think we would call it social justice movements. But as I read the stories of our founders, it was thrilling to see how their values resonate today in different ways, in different language, but there's still these same values that are kind of in our soil and air and water, the values of equality, of simplicity, of social justice, of generous giving, of making the world a better place, of community, of speaking truth to power, of thinking critically. So those values started by those founders are still ours to steward. And that's what I want to talk about tonight. I want to hear what questions you might have. I want to hear about your experiences. I want to hear about your aspirations for the college. But feel free to kind of step back from the Swarthmore mirror as well and share what kind of graduates do liberal arts colleges need to produce? How do we make sure that the graduates of tomorrow continue the traditions of truth and goodness and beauty that liberal arts have always imported to the world? So let's share our ideas and experiences and questions, and then again, not only tonight, but afterwards, let's keep talking. So who's got the first question, story, or observation? Yes, please. Thank you, Lucy. I'll repeat the question in a little bit, in a briefer form. So Lucy had a wonderful experience by the same Jed Rakoff, who reached out to her when she was in law school and helped her in her progress of her career and became a mentor. So the question is, what are we doing now to reach out to our students? Where is Nancy, our career services director? Nancy Burkett is in the back, and you can talk to her directly. Nancy came to Swarthmore several years ago to really help develop our career services, to expand what we're doing, to make sure that our students, while they're at Swarthmore, get the right kind of tools and skills they need to make these connections. And Lisa Lee, who I think all of you probably know, Lisa is somewhere. Lisa's back there. Lisa's our alumni director. And our alumni programs are very focused now on making these connections. And I know that many of you have been involved in our extern programs, our intern programs. They are so important. We aren't a pre-professional school. We have no interest in being a pre-professional school. But how we can help our students is to make sure our students get connected with our alumni, that they get this kind of mentoring, that they get exposure, that they begin to explore connections. So I introduce Lisa and Nancy to you so that if you have an interest in mentoring, in an extern program, in an intern program, you can step forward. We are doing a lot, and the Alumni Council intends to do even more, and I know Nancy intends to do more and more. So thank you. Great question. It's really important in this economy. Yes, sir. Great. So the two comments was lifting up a faculty member who really embodies the meaning of Swarthmore essay, and I imagine for many of us in this room, the faculty embody that. And so I'm going to introduce two other people. Connie, where's Connie? Hungerford, our provost. She oversees the faculty. Connie's way in the back, and she has a big job, but a tremendous job, because she gets to work with those faculty who lift up those values every day. And Gil Rose, who many of you know, who's a classics professor, now retired, he's running our very successful lifelong learning program that's here in New York City as well as in Swarthmore. And I hope you can take some courses through this program. The second comment was about the campus space and wanting to protect the green space and the incredible gardens that we have. And I think that is very important. We have had to add some buildings over the years. Knowledge keeps growing. Sciences keep changing. We have to have space. We need social programming. You know, I know when I go back to my college, I think, why did they have to add that building? But as an educator, you do have to make selected choices, because you've got to have new labs for the sciences or new programs in the arts and things like that. So I know that the board works very hard at being very careful and being very judicious about protecting the beauty of the campus. So point well taken. Yes, ma'am. Okay. So the comment started with an expression of concern about the growth of the administrative staff, and then talked about that so many of the things we say could be said of every college, and what's the distinctiveness of the Swarthmore experience and mission. So let me talk to the first and the third about that, the growth of the administrative staff. Swarthmore, interestingly, has about the same number of staff that Colgate did, and the size is quite different. And I thought, well, let me look at this. What's the difference? What's important to know about where Swarthmore has invested the staff is in learning and teaching. So we have added staff. Some of it's been with regulation. The government keeps adding higher ed regulations, and we keep having to add this or that. But we've also invested in making sure our students have the support they need to be successful. So the second part is, you know, what's the distinct mission of Swarthmore? And I would love to have discussions about that. Today I had lunch with a few alumni, and we talked a lot about how you describe it, how you say it, how you express it. So I'll tell you, you know, one of the things I see. Swarthmore students take thinking seriously. They like to think, they like to read, they like their work. Many of the schools I've been in, the students will work hard in the classroom, but once the class is over, that's it. With Swarthmore students, they ask questions about everything. I go down to the dining hall and I sit there at a table, and the students are talking about some French philosophical thinker and his relevance for the economy. There is, I think, curiosity. Today at lunch, somebody talked about lifelong learning, that the experience, not only the program, Gil, but that the very experience of Swarthmore builds in this kind of quest for learning that allows one to live a life of learning across the whole life cycle. The other thing that I keep hearing from our alumni is that Swarthmore, the combination of the rigor and the size means that most Swarthmore students don't stay in a narrow pigeonhole. They may major in econ and minor in drama, or they may major in astrophysics and minor in religion or philosophy. That there is an ability, because again of the size and the rigor, to learn about thinking across a wide range of disciplines. But let me ask you, how do you describe the distinctiveness of our mission? Yes. Okay, so the question is how I see my vocation as a scholar of religion, as a theologian, reflected in my administrative life. I studied primarily progressive religious communities undergoing change. I studied communities in Latin America undergoing change through something called liberation theology that was a response to the poverty and really international policies for the Latin American countries in the 60s and 70s. I studied the civil rights movement here and how that movement, especially in the South and the Midwest, that's the places I looked at, were carried through the churches, the black churches, and sometimes the white churches, and how those communities changed. And then I also looked at the women's movement in the U.S. and how working class, especially working class women, rewrote their lives and narratives and had to rewrite their religious experiences, and how religion was both an asset and a detriment in those kind of progressive communities. So what I really learned about is how culture, institutions, language, and sometimes personal identity intermix. And that's what really fascinates me. And I think that's the impact it has on me as a higher education administrator, is that when I look at an institution, I look at the institutions, the cultures, the stories people tell themselves, and all the individual personalities and how that works together. Yes? So the question is about ecological position, in a sense, and our present kind of practices and future. One of my great areas of interest is sustainability. And in fact, if you can join us for my inauguration on May 8th, that will be one of the major panels that we focus on. We've been doing a lot. I think you're right that Swarthmore is very committed. We are fortunate that we have an engineering program. We have a lot of students who are very engaged. Did you notice that Swarthmore students love to be engaged? So now they're even starting a little chicken farm on the campus. We'll see how long this lasts. This is about teaching people to live locally with foods. And at first I thought, having grown up in Kansas on a farm, when the students started talking about chickens, I thought, they don't know what they're talking about. But then they brought me this 24-page proposal. It was like this careful, incredible proposal about how it really does connect to sustainability. So, yes, the students are, as always, both rigorous in their thinking, incredibly committed, and they are very engaged. We are starting to explore sustainability in the kind of next generation and where we will take it. I think our facilities, as you note, have increasingly addressed sustainability. We have a LEED certified building, not only our science center, but also two of our dorms now are LEED certified, and we have architects and planners and builders coming from all over looking especially at these dorms. We've got to do several things, I think. We have to continue using our intellectual capital. We have a good environmental studies program, but I'm hoping that in the future years, we can also work with Bryn Mawr and Haverford to make environmental studies a real TRICO area of strength. We are all small. Each one of ours is a small school. If we can combine our bridges, I think we can have much more impact. We have to continue changing our culture. Students have to learn a sustainable lifestyle. It has to be ingrained in them. They have to be the pusher of that value in the future. I think we also have to imagine how it can impact the coursework, not only in environmental studies and in selected faculty who specialize in this area, but how sustainability can be a kind of campus-wide initiative. So thank you for that question. It's an area of great interest to me. Yes, ma'am, back there. So the question is, what kind of directives is the admissions office given? Because, and I think you rightly do the connection, the students that you bring to Swarthmore in some ways carry the values. You use your values to select those students, and they in turn will carry the values. There was reference made to the difficulties some years ago and mind the light and difficult decisions made, and a sense that for some alumni, they look at the school and they say, I wouldn't get in today. So two quick comments about that. And look, you can talk to me about anything. I'm very happy to converse about anything. I don't always have all the answers, though. I've never been in a school where alumni say, I could get in today. Right? And that's good. The value of our education goes up that way. No, it's very, very true. In each and every school I've been a part of, alumni always have this feeling that the generations just keep getting better and better and better. And I think that's something about the kind of natural evolution of what has happened. I also think, and proudly so, America has democratized education. And schools like ours that have the incredible good fortune and amazing moral commitment are able to use a need-blind admissions policy to democratize it even more. Many, many years ago, schools like Swarthmore drew upon a fairly homogenous student body, and they could not send their admissions directors out to Salina, Kansas, where I grew up. Nobody from Swarthmore came to my high school to recruit in Salina, Kansas, I can promise you. Today, we have a girl from Salina, Kansas, because a Swarthmore person went out, and I think that's great. I think it's wonderful to have democratization. So what directives do we give? We want to make sure that the students fit the school. There are lots of great schools in the country. We want to make sure that students can use the opportunities here, that they, even if the academics is a challenge, even if our wonderful faculty have to work double hard to help the student, we want to make sure that the students can flourish. I think that's first and foremost. Is it an academic fit? That doesn't mean that it's an easy fit. We have students who require extra support, who require help, but they use the opportunity. They know how to step forward into the opportunity. So that's one. Second, we want to make, you know, from our perspective, we need to build a class. Adam Hertz is our AD. He's here tonight. Adam, where are you? You know, every time Adam graduates a soccer goalie, we've got to find him a new one. So we've got to find the athletes. We've got to find the students who will be in the university choir. We want students who are engaged in transforming the world. We want to make sure that we pack the Lang Center with students. So we build our class. We have tons of applicants. We had something like 7,560 applicants last year. We look through that very carefully and find students who can use the opportunity, who can add to the class, and who do represent the diversity of the world. You know, we are turning graduates. We are turning out graduates who will go into the most diverse global environment that our graduates have ever gone into, and we need to make sure that in some ways we represent that world. So I think those are kind of the three areas I see. Connie, have I forgotten something? Okay. Yes, way in the back. So this is Mark Canis, who has certainly been a leader in this country already at a young age, in a leader in the world on genocide prevention, and got his start at Swarthmore, so we'll claim that. So the question is, what more can we do to make the world a better place? I want to hear and I want to talk about it. First of all, I think all professions, nonprofit, for-profit, in education, need Swarthmore graduates. So I think we should remember that we build the world intellectually by turning out people who go into banking, who go into higher ed, who go into law, who teach kindergarten, who work in nonprofits. That's important that the kind of values that those Quaker forebears set in motion are carried throughout the professions and the country. I think we should not overlook just that sheer importance of ethical leadership in all fields. The Lang Center, as many of you know, has become both the umbrella organization and the expander, in a sense, of making the world a better place. And the numbers of students who go to the Lang Center keep growing, the outreach keeps spreading, and the number of faculty who are engaged in service learning classes who are now bringing in the social justice and social transformation in the context of their academic classes keeps growing. So we will continue to do that. I have a fantasy, and you all may tell me this is not a good fantasy. I would love Swarthmore College to really become the center of liberal arts, social transformation, rigorous intellectual life in a really expanded way. I would love in this country when people think about, you know, how are we going to save the world? How are we going to save the country? How do we do it intellectually? That they immediately say Swarthmore. I wonder how we can use our facilities in the summer to do that. I wonder how we can reach out to high schoolers. Jean Lang heads up an organization called Project Pericles, which has a number of colleges very committed to the work. And not too long ago, we had all the project directors of Project Pericles on the campus, and I was amazed at the network of programs. So I'd like Swarthmore to help that grow. I think we need to take this movement and expand it. I also don't think that means that each and every student or each and every faculty member has to be engaged in any one particular program. But I think that we want to keep that as a steady drumbeat, and I think we want to get known for that. Liberal arts has always, since its inception, prepared people intellectually, prepared them for their obligations as citizens, and made sure that they had a rich sense of human flourishing through the arts and culture. So I think we need to continue that long trajectory. Yes, sir. So the question is, the comment was appreciation for the kind of vision about getting the students engaged in the world. And the question was getting the students engaged in, you mean strategic planning for Swarthmore? Several years ago, right before Al Bloom announced his retirement, the school was involved, very involved in a round of strategic planning, and students were on those committees. My hope is after we finish our budget adjustment process, because our endowment did take a loss and we are in the process of readjusting our budget, we will again look at the strategic directions of Swarthmore. And I think we'll involve students, and I don't quite know how that process will look right now, so I don't exactly know, but I think students are big stakeholders. Swarthmore involves students in a lot more of the planning activities than many colleges. Swarthmore students served on the presidential search committee. Right now we're searching for a new dean. We've got students on that committee. So as you alums know, that's really kind of part of the tradition and culture. Yes, sir. Thank you. That's lovely. I see people clapping. So, yes. So just to summarize very quickly, in case you didn't hear, and I'll just start with your last sentence, a fusion of joy, with a sense of transformation is a good way to imagine the mission for Swarthmore. And it's certainly about social transformation, but it's really transformation of all types, including self-transformation, and the sense that we need to continue linking what goes on in the classroom with what goes on outside the classroom. Again, each and every class doesn't have to do this, but I think for the students and the faculty to be able to have classes and academic experiences where they combine their intellectual capital with their social entrepreneurship is really wonderful. And again, I'm seeing more and more of this, not only classes that are in Philly, but more and more of our study abroad campus classes will take this into consideration. Yes, sir. So the question is, how can we make sure that his granddaughter, who is 5, family can afford Swarthmore when she's ready for it? It's really a cost about the increase of tuition in selective higher education, in all higher education. As many of you know, public education is growing at a much faster rate right now than private education is. Let me say one or two things, and then I'll see if Tom, who's chair of our finance committee, wants to make any comments. I tell you, I like to toss the tough questions to the managers. First of all, I do think we need to be very proud that well over 50% of our students are in financial aid, and the average financial aid grant right now is about $35,000. So it is, for many families in America, less expensive right now to send your child to a selective liberal arts school or private higher ed than it is a public school. And our financial aid is in the middle and upper middle class as well as in the lower socioeconomic class. I will say, however, if you're in the upper class or upper middle class and you're thinking, oh, good, there usually do have to be extenuating circumstances, like you have 3 or 4 kids in college or something like that. But I'm impressed by Swarthmore's aid policies that reach broadly up and down the socioeconomic register of the parents, and also widely in so many, embracing so many who need aid. You know, I think that one of the real challenges for Swarthmore and every school of private higher education is to examine our fundamental organization or business model, if you will. I think we've got to look at this very seriously. I imagine most of us in this room do not think that we can escalate the cost of education at the same percentage rate we have escalated in the last 20 years. Actually, the escalation rate has decreased some, but we've got to take a serious look at that model. And that's one of the things we'll be doing in the next set of strategic directions. Why has the cost of higher education grown so much in recent years? Some is we have more faculty. Our faculty ratio is usually around 8 to 1, so we have more faculty per student. Somebody mentioned the staff. We do have more staff than we did in 1950. Students now expect health centers, mental health professionals, et cetera. But we also have intense cost drivers around things like information technology and regulation. And I think that's the second time tonight I've mentioned regulation. But if you look, if Adam told you how much this just the NCAA regulation cost every year for athletics, I think you'd be amazed. If we told you how much it cost every time we built a building or other things, I think you would be amazed. There have been some significant drivers. Health insurance is, you know, we are a business that our largest cost is people, our employees, our staff, and our faculty, and and health insurance continues to escalate. So I'm not saying that as a way of excuse. I'm just saying that when you really start drilling down, there are some real cost drivers that aren't about luxuries, but are just environmental factors that have had huge impact on higher education. So we, higher education in general, and Swarthmore in particular, really have to get our hands around this and figure out how to manage it so that your granddaughter can come Tom, do you want to? No. Okay. I think as a president, it's one of the biggest worries there is. Okay. Yes, ma'am. So the question is, what are we doing with the children in the surrounding communities? And, you know, I know time's getting late, so I'm going to keep this fairly brief. And I'm going to get it focused. I'm going to talk about Chester. For many, many years, we have been very active in Chester, and many of you may have worked in Chester, a very, very poor, struggling community that is ranked, I think continues to be ranked at the bottom in its educational programs. In fact, the whole district is in receivership. So we have Lang Center students, scholars, tutoring and working in Chester in a variety of ways. We have helped to start a charter school for the arts in Chester that goes up right now through fifth grade, and we're just beginning to work with other people to imagine what happens next. We have a very, very active and wonderful and powerful children's choir, a Chester Children's Choir, started by John Alston. You can get the CDs. It's amazing, 100 young people who spend their summers on our campus, where our faculty are teaching them science and all sorts of things. Our students are tutoring them, and the students are also engaging in music. One of the most impressive projects that we're doing right now is working with all the other colleges and universities in Delaware County, and we have started an access center in Chester. And this is amazing. You know, schools, you know, prestigious liberal arts schools and community colleges don't work together very often. But all of these colleges have come together, and we have established an access center that is reaching out to students who want to go to college, to adults in Chester who want to get more education, to young children who are beginning to need help and need access on an education. So I think you're absolutely right. I think Arne Duncan is right. We all need to be in partnership with our surrounding communities to make sure that children and learners of any age get access to education. Our future depends upon it. Yes, ma'am, please. So the question is wanting to hear a bit more about how Swarthmore students get engaged in making a difference and distinguishing themselves outside the door. So personally, I have gotten very active in the Lang Center, in working with the plans for the Lang Center to continue expanding the involvement with students. And I've also been meeting with groups of students to hear their vision. Now, I don't know how much, do you know much about the Lang Center? Okay, Jean Lang, would you like to say a word about the Lang Center? We have the founder here. Wonderful words, and I think Jean is so right. If you have a chance to come back, you know, you can talk with students who are working in the Amazon starting hospitals. You can talk to students who are working for educational access in Chester. You can talk with students who are helping lower-income families fill out tax forms. You can talk with students who are going over to Ghana to help with the liberal arts college there, or to Dublin to help with peace studies in the university there. What's amazing to me is that these students are not only doing it, but it's not simply service. They really are using that critical thinking. They're using their intellect for real transformation. So I think we need to stop. There's more food, there's more drink. Let's have more conversation among ourselves. And don't let this be the end. You can email me. You can get on the website. Let's keep the conversation going. Thank you so very much.